Good. I'm going to try and stand still amongst this microphone. I'm not very good at that because I am a pacer. I'm a bit of a wanderer. So if you see me getting agitated, it's not anything that's going on. It's just me. I'm not very good at standing still. But I do have a walkabout one as well. So I might walk about. So hi. Thanks very much for everybody coming out for the lunch today. I'm Neil and I'm going to talk to you a little bit about risk culture. Big topic. And I'm sure you've got lots of questions. And I would like to keep this quite informal in a way that we ask the questions. So rather than waiting until the end, if anybody's got a question on something that I'm saying, I think within reason, let's try and pick that up in situ. If that gets out of control, looks like we're going to run over, then maybe I'll sort of curb it a little bit. But I'd much prefer you to, you know, put your hand up and throw out a question when it occurs. Otherwise, you tend to forget them, or I do. Okay, and because it's a big topic, you know, I've got a rubric here, which is, you know, analysing and measuring risk culture. That's what you signed up for, and conduct risk, and how those two relate, that conduct risk and risk culture. And this was what I put out on the Insights webpage. So this is what lured you here. So that's my rubric, really, for this lunchtime. Okay, so let's kind of kick off. So what is risk culture? You know, that's quite a strange one because people are still grappling with that one, even though we see this plastered over every newspaper these days, particularly the weekend papers, where they go into it in a little bit more depth. I don't know if anybody read the weekend papers, but the insurance industry apparently in the UK is in for it with codes of conduct and codes to try and curb the wild behaviours that are going on in the insurance industry over here. And also APRA and ASEC, they all seem to be sort of piling in with regulations, which is mirroring exactly what was happening in the UK with banks and insurance companies there. So, you know, that really, to a certain extent, answers part of the question of why is the leadership, if we're being cynical, why is the leadership of organisations so interested in this topic? And indeed, why there's so many people here today and LinkedIn online is, you know, because it is very much front of mind in regulators, the public, governments, politics. So this is kind of the reason for this being here is already quite complex. So let's have a little look at what is risk culture. And I'm going to go back a bit here into looking at culture of organisations. Okay, so the word culture, which comes from cultivation, nurturing of something, you know, that's where culture word comes from. And organisational culture has been looked at in business schools for a long time. And we also were kind of aware of what culture feels like. If we were brought blindfolded into a room and you were opened up in an investment bank and you were then maybe you were at the blinds were taken off in an entrepreneurial marketing company, you'd probably know straight away without talking to anyone which one of those two places you were in, because we observe what's going on. Okay, and Deal and Kennedy back in 82 talks about the way things are done around here, which is not a bad definition. But we can see that, you know, plays out in different types of organization. So all of these, you know, we're looking at the artifacts here, the way people are behaving gives us a clue to what's going on in that culture. A little bit of a clue anyway. So organizational culture is the way things are done around here. When no one is looking, perhaps is a little bit more honest. The bottom description, I think, is quite nice and complete. And this is by Sheen, again, probably about 30 years ago, which is talking about these shared basic assumptions and internal, external adaption and integration. And we're looking at these patterns and the way that, that people solve problems and the things that people have found useful to pass on to the next generation or the other members of that organisation. So that's how culture sort of develops. It's quite a slow process. I quite like this culture as a unique emergent property of an organising system of human activity. I come at that with that definition because I come at culture from a complex system perspective. That sounds awfully academic, but that's taking a systems, a holistic view of what's going on in an organisation. But also the tools that are coming through from complexity science are actually quite useful to look at this very complex issue of culture. So why are we interested? Yes, there's a cynical because regulator and the public and the politicians are on us. But I think there's another reason, and this goes back a long way. It's about performance. It's about organisational performance. So we've had, back in 72, Harrison, who is probably one of the academics who really started to look at this in depth. His survey or questionnaire tool is still used today by organisations to measure their culture. And it's this idea of a coherent culture is the link between strategy and performance. So culture, in a way, is described by all of these, really, Harrison, Handy, and Peters and Waterman, included in the famous book In Search of Excellence. In fact, a very useful 7S model that's still touted around in business schools. Okay, was talking exactly this, that his observations or their observations was that when you have a strong, coherent culture, the organization performs better. Okay, so what's this all about? This is about actually getting behaviors that are aligned with where the strategy of the organization is seen to be going. And if you get that right, you get enhanced performance. Okay, you get a very effective organizations. Now, I know people have sort of criticized Peters and Waterman's book, Search of Excellence, but yeah, it's still pretty sound, I think. And when we looked at about 250 engineering organizations in the UK, and that was over a long period, about 8 years, and we trended what was going on in culture, we found the same issue. A report that was done for the Chartered Institute of Professional Development by Bath University, Unlocking the Black Box, exactly the same thing. Is it's the glue between performance and strategy. Okay, this is culture we're talking about. And in work that I did on strategic risk, again, this comes through as a common theme. Maybe no great surprise. So that's why I think we should be interested in culture beyond what the regulators are talking. Because I think if we probably get that as the driver, things would all slot in a little bit easier. And this is just a sort of a simple 2x2 matrix where we're looking at the coherence of the culture. Now, what this means is how closely are people in that organization behaving and being influenced by the organization, the co-workers and the leadership, etc. How coherent is that? How visible is that in a way? If it's coherent, you can probably see it. And on the bottom axis, on the bottom axis, we have here the alignment of strategic goals. So when those are both aligned up, we have high performance and also a very resilient organization. Okay, this can take knocks because it can recover because it's got those built-in behaviors. Where you don't want to be is down the bottom here, sort of kind of going nowhere. There's no coherent culture and your strategy is, misaligned. So a useful tool to think about where organisations are. So that's really, I think, one of the drivers for me why organisations should get engaged in culture, but also risk culture. So what's the difference? Well, going back to my definition about culture is derived from a sort of human activity. I would say a purposeful human activity. If you're doing anything purposefully, you start to build a culture around that and a language. So whether that's picking and cooking mushrooms, as they do a lot in Italy. You know, there's a whole language, a very rich language, that builds up around that, and behaviours and processes and norms. Okay, and any activity we do that is important, a culture will emerge. So when we're talking about risk culture, really for me, I think what we're talking about is a risk management culture. It's the activity of doing risk management in an organisation, which is usually across the whole organisation, in the financial section certainly. And that's the risk culture that we're talking about. Health and safety culture is about the activity of health and safety, stopping people getting injured and killed. Innovative culture, it's about how we do innovation. So these are all, in my mind, subsets of an organisational corporate culture. So it's one strand, and that's how I like to think about it. So it's the way risk management's done around here when no one's looking. It's around the risk management activity. And this last point here is, one of the things we can't do is just simply add up. You know, whatever we're looking at as individuals within a culture, we can't just add that up and say, well, that's the score. You know, this is what the culture must be. It's much more complex, because it is the interactions of those behaviours around that purposeful activity that we're really observing. And we observe the whole collective of that. So for me, and I keep using the word purposely here, it's about behaviours. Okay, this is trying to look at the behaviours of people, not what people are thinking, not what they might do, not what their personality might do. For me, the key to trying to understand this is trying to observe people's behaviours. Another thing we know from research, which is pretty clear, and you probably get a sense of it already, is when faced with something that's unfamiliar, it's an ethical issue or a compliance issue or a risk-related decision, we know that, and in this order, that people will look to their frontline leader, their frontline supervisor, and see how they behave. And they tend to follow that lead. So what does that mean? Well, we know from Milgram's work decades ago how obedient we can be. Okay, so this is part of it. So we can actually end up, at least in theory, or pretending to be giving people electric shocks. And when told to do it, we will do it. Okay? That's how obedient we can be. Someone comes in with a uniform on a train or a bus and asks for your seat, most of the time you'll give it to them. Okay? So we're kind of trained for that a little bit. That's one aspect of it. But also when we're looking at this, you know, making a risk-based decision, we are looking for what does the leader do. We take a really strong read from that. And it's particularly here in a crisis. That's when leaders really kind of show the colours, I guess. What they pay attention to, and that means how do they get remunerated, how do they reward people in the organisation, how do they discipline people in the organisation, who do they hire, who do they fire, who do they mentor, what's the mentoring look like. And then probably lastly on that list is the artifacts, what it looks like in the organisation, the policy. And here's one of the big dilemmas that I see in organisations trying to get their risk culture right, is culture is strongly linked, we know, to the apex of the organisation and influenced by that, and so it should be. That's about the strategy. But how is it experienced down at a local level? How is it felt when that's been filtered down layers of management within an organisation? And for me, that's one of the big challenges. How do the leadership make sure that what they would like to see as behaviours in their organisation actually gets all the way through, without the sort of the reinterpretation and reinterpretation, as inevitably happens, charge of the light brigade, etc. Second thing is, we turn to our co-workers. If the leadership's not about, and we're not being particularly influenced for that because we can't see it, it's not visible, we turn to our co-workers to look to see how they're behaving. That they're probably doing it the right way, so I'll fit in. And if you've ever been new on a job, you'll know how this feels. You're looking around and thinking, well, what do people wear? How do they act? How do they behave on the phone? All of those sort of things. You're starting taking clues from that quite early on. So here we have, okay, they're not co-workers, but you know, you're all going to work together anyway. But this is just how people will, sort of the norms of behaviour just pick up. I particularly like this top one. And I looked at this closer today when I was going through my slides, and I thought, oh, there's Australia up there. And you know, where is this? Is it Australia? Oh, and look, there's New Zealand. They got things in the pin board on New Zealand, and I don't know, but whenever I go to New Zealand, there's a lot of people walking around in bare feet, let alone in the office. So that probably, I would say that's somewhere in New Zealand. I hope I'm not insulting anybody there. Look for the barefooted person in the room. And then lastly, we turn to our own moral compass, so the research says. And that's influenced by our own self-image, by motivations, our own personal liabilities, our previous experience is pretty big on that. So, you know, that's where we start coming in. When we're not getting heavily influenced, we're on our own, nobody's looking at us, we can't sort of turn for that norm help. We sort of have to go with what we think is right. And that's why, I can't press the little button. That's why I particularly like this photograph from about the Milgram experiment. There is somebody, and not everybody agreed to actually press the button to give an electric shock. Some people didn't. And this sort of clearly is that look. I'm looking back for leadership here. I'm not getting it. There's nobody around. What am I going to do? Maybe I won't do anything. This is certainly what this chap's feeling, I think. I know you probably think that's me, but I think I'm the one either stuck on the wall or having a picnic over there instead, because both of those look pretty scary. Okay. We know, I think, what culture looks like when it's inappropriate. And we're talking big sums of money here too, aren't we? And it's interesting as well is, none of this has happened in Australia, of course. These are all, you know, examples from overseas, because it doesn't happen here at all, obviously. You know, I couldn't find any online, really, so I think it'd be totally inappropriate for me to even suggest it, such a thing. But yeah, you know, this has happened around the world with significant consequences, which has been put down to the root is the culture. And some of these stories, I think, are just, you know, when you read them, you just can't actually believe that people were allowed to get away with those sets of behaviours. Okay, so let's have a little look at some of the approaches that are taken by financial institutions, as I'm aware of it from research and personal experience and a couple of case studies as well. So what's going on? I think the first place here is, you know, what do we want to achieve? And I think there is a muddle here when we start talking about risk culture. And this is something that we ought to stop and think about. Is it about regulatory compliance? Is this why we're looking at risk culture? If so, maybe we should look at, you know, if it's about evidence of an existing, you know, form of risk culture that the regulator wants to see, well, let's do a risk culture profile. We can do that. We can do some form of a profile and give that to the regulator and say, look, this is what we are. We can look at the present culture and we can map ourselves on some risk maturity framework. There's plenty about. If, on the other hand, we're looking at the organisational resilience and performance, then maybe we should go into a little bit more detail and look at our culture in some depth. And I'll talk about how maybe we could do this. And we can make comparison to other organisations, to industry norms, to look at how we're progressing on our risk culture. So this, for me, is a bit of a different set of initiatives that are required if we're looking at resilience and performance. If we're looking for stakeholders, the public and outside, customers, what they're looking for really is how are you kind of close to some sort of benchmark? Is your risk culture about okay for the industry? And have you got clear and consistent feedback in the reporting? This is an important one, I think. Is not doing it once. This is doing regular assessments of the risk culture, profiling that, and making it available for people to look at. I'm not saying that that's not censored to some degree before it's released, but you know, that's what people want to know, is this is a fairly visible process that's happening within the organisation. So how can we do this? So I'm going to go into now a couple of models and approaches. It's not meant to be totally comprehensive, because there's lots of consultants, there's lots of theories. But let me try and give you sort of bucket these into different approaches. First ones fall back onto these organisational cultural models. And nearly all of them, and I sort of alluded to, you know, sort of Handy and Cameron and Quinn is one that that follows Handy's one very sort of closely. Dale and Kennedy, again, they tend to be that typical 2x2 matrix. You will do a fill in a bit of a questionnaire and it will push you in one of those quadrants or another, or you can do some observations and you can sort of plot where they sit in there. You know, not without merit. It's useful. It gives you some idea of where you sit within that framework, at least. Cameron and Quinn is actually got a half decent little case study in here, which is the Federal Reserve's latest release last week, I think, on behavioural risk management and financial services industry. I don't think they've completely cracked it, but they've got some interesting work in there, and they seem to, for some reason, be favouring Cameron Quinn, because I guess they're an American organisation, or American researchers anyway. So they're good, and I've used most of these models in the past. I particularly like Handy's model. That's free in here for a $6 or $7 book. You can go and get yourself a model and you can apply it within your organisation and it works not bad. Just adapt the language for risk and you've probably got something there. And in fact, if any of you are interested, this is a really good book to start understanding where culture, you know, this is an easy read, but it's well researched, and that's a good starting point for anybody who's interested in this topic. It covers other things as well, but it's, you know, doesn't look too academic either. So, you know, these models are there and they are useful. They tend to be biased from the point of view of, we're sending out a questionnaire that is usually where do you rank, you know, 1 to 5 or 1 to 7. And we know those are problematic. We don't need to tell actuaries that they're problematic. There is a bias. There's also the issue of gaming. You know, it's quite easy to sort of push your answers to the right quadrant in these models. I know you can't get rid of that completely, but that's one of the problems with it. But it's a starting point. If you're completely blind, then there's somewhere to go. There are some models. Thompson and Mary Douglas have come at this from an anthropological perspective. And that's a political and social model. Again, it ends up into a bit of a 2x2 matrix. Harder this time to actually plot exactly which one you're in, because it seems to be a blend of 2 or 3. But very useful for giving you that social dynamic. So here these models at least are trying to talk about a dynamic between those four quadrants and how you move from one to the other. And to a certain extent, actually, the Cameron and Quinn model has these competing values. So rather than just saying they're quadrants that, you know, you can sit in, there is a tension between some of these different quadrants. And that's quite useful. I think it makes it probably a little bit more robust. Personality type tests and psychometric assessments. These seem to have quite a lot of, you know, they've been adapted quite quickly by the publishing organisations from you know, the British Psychological Society to others, that claim to have some insight into risk behaviours, risk culture, risk climate, all of these sorts of things. I have a fundamental problem with them. Again, it's that bias in there, because we're asking how I would behave in this situation. That's problematic, because we know we don't always behave as we think we would like to behave. So I just have a bit of a natural problem with that. But they have claimed validity. The repeatability for me is across an organisation is more questionable. And again, some of them are almost like party games now, where you fill them out, the Myers-Briggs, etc. You can see I'm not coming from an HR or a psychologist background here, can't you? Okay, then what I've seen a lot in banks particularly, they do this internal groups with or without the assistance of consulting organisations, and they do in-depth interviews with target parts of their business that they maybe see it's either the regular part of audit or ones that have been pushed up the order of priority. And they do one-to-one interviews, they code those, they draw some themes, they use grounded theory to pull together a bit of a unique view of what that subunit of the organization's culture is and where there's maybe any potential conduct issues too. So, you know, that has a bit of a double assessment. It's confidential and it's face-to-face, and you can see the organization, you can see how somebody's reacting to you, usually done with psychologists or behavioral scientists, and it's a really good process, I think. You know, you will learn an awful lot about the organization. The trouble is, it's expensive and time-consuming. And as I was saying to someone just over the lunch there, at least one organization I know had sort of 90 plus business units, and they were doing four a year, and that's going to be about 20 years. And things change in 20 years. So how do you get around that? It's throwing more and more resources at it. Maybe. But that's a decent process. I can't really argue with that one particularly. Another approach is, and one that we've kind of advocated, is really looking at constructs. So the literature is full, from risk management to culture, of these ideas. What are these dimensions, these constructs, these two-ended views that we use to assess the world? So here now, there's no sort of 1 to 7 scale. We have to make a choice between which end of this pole we're in. Okay, so the constructs become for me much more useful because they create that tension, almost that stress of how people behave. So, that is going into a body of literature that's pretty well proven. Again, I'm coming at this from a holistic system perspective. So obviously, I think this is a good way of doing it, but, you know, it's about observed behaviours. Because we're looking for behaviours, you know, the best way in my mind is to say not how you would behave, but how do you see people behaving in your organisation, okay, in your business group? How do people behave in different situations? When have you seen that? So those are the sorts of questions you can ask people. That's not without bias, I grant you. You know, there's perceptions and how you're reading, I get it. But I think it's far less biased than some of these other approaches and surveys. So I tend to follow these sort of bottom two a little bit. Why is that not working? I don't know. Battery's gone. I've switched it off. Ah, that's useful now. Right. Okay, that doesn't want to play. And I've put this framework, and I don't want to come across as consultant talking here, but I do think this kind of captures some of the key elements in what's going on in risk culture. So here, sort of top to bottom, we've got strategy linking down to performance. And in my mind, each of these boxes here are systems. They're subsystems of the overall risk culture system. So they're like those strands of the rope. and they're all interconnected, but I don't want to show all the interconnections because it gets really busy. So they all related, they're all influencing each other. But that top two, from strategy down through to performance, is really important, and culture's at the heart of that dynamic. Then the sort of square that goes around it with the orange arrows, this is kind of taking up some of the key themes that you see from nearly all of the literature. In fact, it's quite gratifying that the same sort of metrics are coming out as the key metrics from the Fed report as well. So it's how the communication comes down. So this issue of, you know, how do the leaders communicate? How is communication done across the organization is one key measure. Where are the resources coming? What are you resourcing? How is that resource renewed? That will tell you a lot about the culture. What is the reward and consequence system? How do people get rewarded for what? What is the consequence if they don't do what they're supposed to do? And then the governance and decision making. So this is probably the structure that all of these others flow through. So, you know, how are decisions made in that organization? So I think that kind of ties up for me these main threads, but I won't push it anymore. Except that what we've kind of tended to do with this is pull in this national level, which again, for large organizations, international organizations, is a real challenge, of how you deal with your business units that are outside, should we call it an Anglo-Saxon type environment? So, you know, Asian, African, South American. This is a big challenge. You know, what influences what the most? The research will show that your national culture will influence your organizational culture. And how that is, are you aware of that? And how is your organization making sure that the stamp of your culture for your organization doesn't get watered down too much? And that for me is one of the modern challenges, but not, maybe that's another discussion another day. An organizational and this individual level. So, and this is just a slide I've put in here for to sort of pick up what a construct is, if that was kind of a bit too balmy for you. But it's this idea of attention. So a typical one would be, do people behave towards producing results that is result-driven, or is it about the process of actually how you get to that end result, the values and the behaviours? So, you know, yes, you can. And when I showed this to a couple of CROs, one person put and said, well, our organisation wants both ends of that. Yes, of course. Of course, every organisation would like both of that. But when a push comes to a shove, what are the behaviours you observe that actually are occurring in the organisation, particularly under a bit of stress? And we'll find that they're not both ends. That will be one end. So anyway, these are six of those most common out of all of the literature that come out. We might call these different depending on what audience you're looking at, but we don't need to go into these particularly today. Just to let you know that you can boil down an awful lot of these constructs into a few. So we're not talking about measuring 80 different type constructs across the organization. Six will work. And you can then ask around those six questions. And in fact, for each construct, you can ask as many questions as you like around that construct to test it. In fact, three questions around each construct is recommended, because you get some internal validity about what you're actually measuring. And if one of your questions doesn't tie up, then you can throw it out or understand why it's not giving you the same as the other two. So, and what that's doing is probing around that construct. And in fact, we had one client in the UK who wanted us to ask questions around each of the core risk management, identification, measurement, analysis, and feedback. They wanted it to reflect the ISO sort of framework, which worked okay, actually. I didn't think it would, but it did sort of work okay. It made it complicated. But so what we kind of do is you ask someone, you know, to pull this one way or the other. Yes, you can sit in the middle, but you need to explain yourself. Okay, is it because you can't observe any of those behaviours, whatever it might be? So, a couple of quick case studies, and then I'll take any questions that are going on here. So, this is actually the one that where we did look at these five dimensions. And so we ended up with 30-odd questions. The one aspect of that framework that I didn't include that I normally would like to see in there is short-term or long-term focus. That wasn't in that model I showed you a minute ago. That's because we pick it up in what are the behaviours that you're currently seeing around you and what are the behaviours that you'd like to see around you. So we kind of pull that forward dimension and that future dimension by giving a second wording to each of those questions. So that gives that time element, which I think is quite important. So that looks all quite busy, but the data through that is you know, you can look at averages. You can start, as you all know, you can start cutting up the data to tell you some interesting things, because you can put in some demographic questions in here that can be totally confidential, but all you need to know is what business you're sitting in, and then you can start triangulating on behaviours. So just for example, and these are going to be really quick, and this insurer we actually did, and I have to put my hand up and thank Milliman for the contribution to this, because we did it in conjunction with them, is the key thing that came out of this was the three, we boiled it down to identification, analysis and mitigation, is on these constructs where the organisation was doing, because of their risk culture, they were doing some of those aspects of the risk management quite differently. Okay, so here we can see that the mitigation and the analysis is actually being treated culturally quite different from the identification. Okay, so that was quite interesting. A sort of a second sort of follow-up to that was this was an insight into how long people had been in the organisation and how old the people in that organisation and the risk management function anyway were. And we see here quite a difference on these constructs here of people that have been in the organisation a longer term. So there's much more focus towards task, towards the professional orientation and not a local orientation of the organisation, about tight control and customer focus here. So that was much more prevalent in the older, longer serving people in the organisation. That was a big important message for how they could change some of those processes that they had to make sure everybody got a little bit more aligned. Okay. And of course, what you can do with this as well is you can use the same approach with many of these other tools as well, is actually to map the top team. What is the behaviours that they would like to see? Now, I have to say that often can take quite a long time because, you know, what are those values? Do they all agree? How do we actually get those to look quite coherent from the board or the senior team? But once you do that piece of work, you have that benchmark of where they're trying to get to. And then you've got something to be able to measure. How far away are we from where the top team would like this organisational behaviours to be? And then you know where to start doing some work. Okay, you don't need to start everywhere. You've got to, you know, let's start on the bits where we got the biggest difference. It kind of makes sense. Okay, that's a bit of a wiggly version of the other one, and I've simply got some questions coming in. I might just stop. And for the people on, this is sort of saying something similar. I'll let you look at these online. And I realised this morning that I've got two exactly the same one. I don't know how I did that. There must have been a really interesting one that I put in there afterwards. Let me just take this question, if you don't mind, and we'll maybe move on after that. So this question was, I was interested to see that risk management processes don't feature in your holistic and dynamic best practice framework. What is your thinking here? Very good question. Shall I read that again? So I've got time to think about it. I was interested to see that risk management processes didn't feature in your holistic and dynamic. Yeah. I don't think they need to be shown in there, the risk management process, because it is about risk management. That's what we're actually trying to do, is the culture around the activity of risk management. So I wouldn't be including the risk management processes in that, if that makes any sense. Does that make any sense to the audience here? Does that make any sense to the person online? let me know. Maybe that was a bit of a deeper question that I'm not actually fully understanding. So, okay. Here's a national insurer, and this is mainly to show one of the things I've learned is just about every organisation we've ever worked with, either on research or consulting, is they want their data in a different format. They want different pictures. Everybody wants it differently, which is fine, and so it should be. So there's, you know, adaptable. We've learned now, we stuff all the data into Excel and play in Excel. We used to drive our software people crazy trying to, you know, make this automatic for this organisation. We don't do that anymore. Yeah, that's the way we kind of deal with that. We might advise them of how we then interpret it in Excel, but yeah, get the data in first and then we can play with it. So where does conduct, and this is a question I heard over lunch as well, you know, where does this fit in? Well, I think it's quite simple. Conduct is bad behaviour, and there's that word again, behaviour. So what we're looking for is individual behaviours here that are inappropriate, wrong, don't fit in with the culture, don't fit in with legislation, don't fit in with the rules of the organisation, whatever it might be. So we're looking at those odd behaviours, the one that's out there. That for me is the difference. And because culture is all about that dynamic of different behaviours, it's kind of just a subset of the same thing. We're looking at one individual, maybe how that individual's being influenced, yes, and that's quite important for identifying potential spots. How do organisations deal with this? You know, banks and regulated industries, of course, there is data being collected and emails are monitored and that's all been done real time. And I do know of organisations that have tools to, you know, troll through that, as in big data type world, and look for anomalies and report those and spit them out. I'm not totally sure how ethical that is, to be honest, and how effective. I think you've got to be very careful to make sure you know what you're making these connections across, you know, these datas when you try to do this stuff. We have done this a little bit, and I'll explain how we've done it. But if I'm not saying this is necessarily the only way to do this, because some of those other techniques are reportedly, you know, gaining ground and working. If you can get hold of people's personal data, then sure, I can see how that would be useful. I still think it helps to come from reporting other people's behaviour, you know, observing other people's behaviour, because very quickly you can triangulate on that. If I saw, as we have done, we've seen perhaps hot spots in an organisation, that's when you send in the psychologist and you go face to face and you find out what's going on. And you will probably, without actually having to name a name, you'll know that there's a problem there somewhere. I'm sure you'll get 99% of it if you follow a process like that. You know, if someone's deliberately trying to, you know, hide this, but a lot of it is just the norms sort of lead people to do things that start becoming in, you know, embedded wrongness. Okay, so let's just say these are the same sort of constructs as we were just talking about before. Now, you know, in a slightly cliche type way, what we can look for is individual profiles that are indicating archetypal type conduct risk. So let's just, for example's sake, you know, the mis-selling scan. If there's an individual who's very highly or is spotting behaviours around them that are very high results orientated type behaviours with the culture, coinciding with a strong cultural focus in those behaviours. Did I say cultural focus? I meant customer culture focus. Okay? So, you know, the culture is pushing this individuals and they're seeing around them this culture that's driving individuals around them to be high results orientated, high customer focused. That's what happened in mis-selling. Okay. Now, if you could see that two or three people are reporting in their business unit or in their group of those sorts of behaviours going on, You should go and look at that. This is telling you something. If one individual says that, you know, maybe that's a one-off, and you can sort of reassess that. But it's quite easy to sort of scan through for individual behaviours on here. And because this is anonymous, we're not actually trying to say it's, you know, Joe Bloggs or any one individual. You're just saying people are observing this sort of behaviour around them. Okay? I think that's much more useful and much more ethical too, I think.
Sorry, can I ask a question?
Of course.
A few slides beforehand, you had a different graph, and everybody seemed to be going towards process rather than goal-oriented.
Yeah.
Whereas this one is completely different. And I agree, actually, with the yellow point, that it can, if you are too much towards process, you know, if you are too much on your process, and that can be just as much a problem as whereas the red one, I mean, yes, that could be excessively aggressive self, but it actually also could be somebody who actually thinks outside the square and who is actually goal-orientated, because you would want some goal-orientated people in your organization.
Yep.
These are the ones who bring innovation and, and see risk management as opportunity, and not just negatively, whereas the people who tend to be process oriented seem to be one who think risk is always negative.
Yes. No, that's a very good question, and a point that I kind of missed to stress earlier on, is that, and it's this whole thing about good and bad culture, you know, because we hear regulators talking about, we want a strong or a good culture. I mean, what is that? You know, how do we going to, we're never going to measure good. What we are going to measure is appropriate. So your point is exactly right. Now, if that was coming out of, say, the sales team of an organization, and, you know, they were high on results and customer focus, yes, of course. How strong is that is another question. But the first thing to look at is those groupings that you would see within different business units. Is that appropriate for what they're trying to do? There's not going to be a nice, constant culture across any organization. Different pockets. Your accounting and payrolls people, Lord knows we don't want them to be innovative and sort of be too slack. You know, we would like that to be process orientated and bunging out the paycheck every week or month. So,
so I really, to come to my question,
yeah. Just examples. Yeah, they're just examples. Yeah, I'm just putting those on there.
Yeah. Okay, so that doesn't relate to the one you showed.
Oh, sorry, no. Yes, that's not the same individual. No. No, they would be a bit schizophrenic if that was what we're looking
at. No. Because I thought
No. That's it is the same thing. So, but what I'm doing is just put those dots on there as an example. I mean, if you got the results of a whole group came back with both of those sort of heading up as being problematic, you might have both of those issues going on, perhaps. Yeah. No, sorry, that was misleading there. Yeah. Okay. But that's a really good point. I think, you know, what is an appropriate culture is the right way to think about that, not good or bad. We can start. We did sort of take this to a slightly different level, and this was actually in a merger. In a company that we were looking at, and without going into a whole bunch of detail here, what connecting these individual returns back gave a little bit of an insight of what was going on in the organization here that was trying to merge. So what we were looking for here is we did have. And when we went back through the individual ones, we could look at someone's position with the organization, and that represents the size of these, so the power position, we would call it, the size of the circle, size of the node. The connections between them is how similar or dissimilar they were based on the profile. And what we were looking at there is, red, obviously it said, is, you know, this is one where the values weren't lined very well to the merger's values. Okay. I mean, this is a classic, you know, in cultural theory and in practice, is what goes on when you have two cultures that come together in an organisation. I think the static wisdom is that it's the biggest one and the one who's taking over, because there's no such thing as a merger. That's the one that sort of rules out. But that's not really the whole story. You know, at the end of the day, there is usually a coming together. And what does that future culture need to look like? What are the future values of the combined organisation? So that gets kind of quite complicated, but this starts to show where maybe you have some issues. So if we look at this individual here, when this is all pulled back, is very highly influential and connected to lots of people around them. Okay, but they're also connected to some quite sort of powerful people in the organisation, sort of more senior people, who will probably be able to, going back to the theory earlier on, be able to influence them if they're aware of that. They might not know who it is exactly, but maybe they need to project the values of that organisation a bit more strongly. And it also looks for ones which were, you know, very red. These are ones that people are not yet aligned. Where are they in the organisation? Where do we need to do some more work to make sure that the values of the combined and the new merged organisation are more appropriate? Or maybe these people will never change. Again, that's where you'd move into talking to other disciplines to actually figure out what's going on there and do some deep dives in those parts of the organisation to find out what's going on. How similar and dissimilar the results were on the six dimensions. Yeah, they're closely connected. Yeah. And that was one part of it, and also where they sat in the organisation. So it was like a double factor. Okay, sort that one out. Any questions? Those are really just two examples. I don't think we've probably got time for any of those. No. What do you do with the risk analysis? You then go on to do other things, is my sort of trite answer to that last question on there. It is only the starting point for more work that you go and do. For me, it's trying to target where you should start doing that extra work. Because there will be limited resource in the organisation to improve the risk culture in your organisation. Where are you going to put it? And what initiatives are you going to start? By taking the first steps forward, you start having an idea of where to look at that. Okay, that's really my concluding slide there for you to read, and while anybody thinks about a question.
Ashley Palmer from Aon. Thanks for that presentation, Neil. Very interesting, particularly on stuff on the sort of current state analysis. I guess my question is, how are organisations going on in terms of thinking about their desired state? How do they kind of articulate or begin to understand where they want to be? I guess all of these models and tools are particularly useful at kind of a snapshot of where they might be at today, but how do they kind of get that futuristic kind of desired state?
You've got to sit down with the board or the top team. And you need to talk to them. I mean, there will be espoused values of every organisation. Okay, that'll be printed. There'll be statements to that effect. My experience, often people find that really hard to articulate that. So we do need to, or you need to help them articulate exactly what that means. And for us, that means turning it into desired behaviours. And once people get the hang of that, they actually can sort of see what that means, rather than saying, we want to be a trusted organisation. Well, what does that mean? When we turn that into behavioural traits, what would it mean if we were a trusted organisation? How would people be behaving? And so you're absolutely right. It's not something that is naturally done. I mean, it's not something that it's not a bad exercise, actually. I would say that the top team should be thinking about how that articulates into behaviour, so they can spread the word better. But yes, they tend not to have that in their bottom drawer, and you need to do an exercise with them to get that. And it's probably a critical part of the process.
In terms of the definitions, I like the when no one is looking part of both culture and risk culture. But what I grapple with is how do you measure the when no one is looking part?
Well, I think really that's meaning when usually the boss is not looking. So usually there's other people looking. Okay, so people are looking at behaviours. If you run your own at your computer screen, then probably nobody else is looking.
You still get the biases.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I'm not suggesting for any minute that there's a bias free. And if people want to misbehave, they're really smart. Some people, and they will find a way to misbehave, and so that nobody does see them. Usually, and that's a lone wolf, and you can look for the lone wolf or wolverine. Such a thing. But most of the time, you know, when you look back at the big ones that have gone off, you know, people kind of knew and were turning a blind eye. They were aiding and abetting us above and below the people that were doing the bad things in the organisation. So, you know, I think the lone wolf is a very small percentage of the bad conduct examples that come out, certainly that I'm aware of. And people do, you know, it's amazing what people do know. But, you know, with all the whistleblower, you know, things in place, the culture still puts a hand on that and says, you can whistleblow, but, that will feel very odd for many people. That still hasn't, in my mind, really become a valid tool for organisations to spot stuff. I don't think it's in the psyche. The cultures are not allowing that to happen, to be an open culture. Most of them are more closed than allowing that to happen. It's a valuable one. If it works, don't get me wrong. But, you know, I don't think it always ends well for whistleblowers. Or is that the perception that's put out there? So people don't whistleblowers. Right, well, it looks like we're spot on timing. Any other questions? Good. Any questions from online? Are we all good? But feel free, there's my contact details if anybody does want to send me a question.
So this one's from Meredith Books. Is there any evidence of the predictive power of these sorts of evaluations?
Is that alluding to predictive analytics? Yeah, I think there is, and I think we will see. I think we'll see bigger strides happening in that area. It's working across in other areas of your industry, so I see that happening with the human dynamics and the metrics that we're picking up, and certainly, you know, that one advantage of the techniques that certainly we're deploying and others are deploying is, you know, this is web-based. You're picking up an awful lot of information, and so you can start doing some interesting analytics with that. My caution is you just got to be careful what you're actually spitting out and how you're making connections and what that's actually telling you. And therefore, you need a framework. You need to understand what you're doing rather than just running analytics and spotting anomalies. You need to understand what that's telling you. So, you know, a basic understanding of people's behavior and what culture is required in the background. But, yeah, inevitably that's going to be more and more powerful. It's not my area of expertise, but I know people who are doing it and swear blind they can tell all sorts of things.
At the start,
the audience really, rather than me.
At the start, you mentioned performance is directly linked to culture. How do you ensure appropriate behaviour and thus culture where conflicting KPIs may exist?
Yeah. It is the link, and the key is getting the culture right. And if KPIs are there, it's kind of leading towards a certain culture. And it will lead to certain behaviours. And if that's not really aligned up with what your strategy and your approaches and the way people actually are behaving in the organization, then that won't work. I go into some organizations where KPIs are used, they're understood, they're refined, they're important KPIs, people measure them, they value them, they report on them, the feedback's right, performance is aligned, people are behaving accordingly. It works. I've seen other organizations introduce KPIs and it gets bogged down, and I'm thinking of a lot of public services in the UK, National Health Service, London Transport, you know, the like, so I don't go into the financial sector particularly, but I know that will be happening the same. You know, where are those metrics? How do those metrics get distorted? Rewards is one that will distort it. Yes, we want the KPIs, but we also want profit. You know, it's those sorts of tensions and dilemmas that tend to slice apart the culture that stops that performance. Because it sounds really easy. You know, we get great performance when the culture's aligned with the strategy. It kind of sounds, oh, that's that easy. But actually, it's a really hard act to do. But you know when they're doing it. And one that keeps striking me is Disney. I don't know if anybody's ever, you know, beat a Disney park with their kids. You know, for me, it's amazing how you get minimum wage employees who just know what to do. You know, they are trained in photography that will take photographs of you and your kid, and, you know, they'll sweep up. You know, I don't know. I don't know how they do. Well, I do know how they do it. It's training, and very clear cultural tricks to enable them to maintain that. We don't all have, you know, for one of the tricks that they have is you're on stage or you're off stage. So when you're on stage, when you're customer facing, you don't swear, you don't spit, you don't smoke, you don't drink, you don't kick the little kids, because you're on stage, you're acting, and you're doing a performance, and that performance should be your full performance. And they train them how to do that performance. You know what the words are, you can change the words, but this is within what the performance should be. So you're performing. When you go off stage, you know, you can relax and kick back. That's a really neat cultural trick. So what can you do in your organization to get something similar to that that's so powerful that will enable behaviors to be aligned up? And companies do. You know, your ferry services, for me, is a great example of a cultural norm that is built in there that provides really great performance. So you can do it, but it's not easy, and it comes deep down, not just through KPIs. That's a really long answer to a quite a straightforward question, but yeah, a good one, yeah. So you've all got to go off to Disney now. Take some kids and see how you get on. Must admit, when I went, I thought I was going to hate it. I actually enjoyed it despite myself, yeah. Yeah, very clever. Okay, well, thanks very much for listening to me. And any questions, I'm going to hang around afterwards. So, yeah, thank you very much. I think that's a close.